You're listening to episode 203 of Women Worldwide. How would you rate yourself as a negotiator? Do you negotiate as if your life depended on it? I've got a guest today who knows how, and he's got great advice for you. So stay tuned to learn more. Hi, I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. I've spent an entire career helping women to share stories, nurture relationships, grow their brands, but most of all, to find their voices so they can make a difference. Do you feel stuck? Do you want to power up your own voice? Women Worldwide features the stories of passionate women who have navigated big career challenges and some of the toughest changes. These professionals offer deep insights and advice to inspire you and to help you uncover what's holding you back. Let Women Worldwide ignite your passion so you can excel in life. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Women Worldwide. Before I introduce my special guest today, I just want to give you a Women Worldwide update. Not only have we surpassed 200 episodes, but we are nearing 2 million downloads. And I can't thank you enough for all of the sharing of the stories of these amazing people that come on the show. You're helping to amplify their voices, their passion, and to create a difference in this world. So thank you. All right, well, let's get to today's topic and guest. First, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you think you're a good negotiator? Do you get a raise every time you ask for it? Or do you win every single contract? And maybe think about it. Are you able to shift someone's mindset so they don't even realize that they're getting something, but it's what you want them to get and what you actually want yourself? Well, this is the perfect segue to my guest on the show. Joining me is Chris Voss, who is a former FBI hostage negotiator. Chris is the CEO and founder of the Black Swan Group. He's also the author of the book, which I love, and I've read from cover to cover, Never Split the Difference, Negotiate as If Your Life Depended on It. There's so much that I could share about Chris, but I think it's best that he shares his journey with you. So, Chris, I'm thrilled to have you on my show. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's an absolute pleasure to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here, and I wish we had hours to talk about everything in your book, because this is a book that is a game changer. And, you know, before we dive in, I just want to sort of set the stage for all the Women Worldwide listeners. Maybe you could share what made you want to become an FBI hostage negotiator. How do you get into that?
Well, actually, I thought it was going to be easy. I was originally on a SWAT team with the FBI, and I really liked crisis response. I liked when people have to make up their minds, when they have to decide. I don't like procrastination. People got to make up their minds in crisis. I had a recurring knee injury, and I still want to stay in crisis response besides my duties as an investigator. So I thought, you know, I'll be a hostage negotiator. How hard could that be? I could talk to terrorists.
That's amazing. How hard can it be? Well, you know, you write about in your book all about these techniques for negotiation and sort of shifting mindsets and different ways of looking at how to negotiate. So maybe if you can just talk a little bit about your book and what you want readers to understand.
Yeah, you know, and so getting back to, you know, how hard it's going to be to talk to people. I mean, it can be really hard. And that was the thing that I loved about it. I mean, I had to take a deep, in-depth dive way back then on, I didn't realize it, but emotional intelligence. I had to volunteer on a suicide hotline because I was unqualified to be a hostage negotiator just because I'd been on a SWAT team. That was really all I had going for me. And, you know, the suicide hotline is people being emotional, which is pretty much everyday existence. So once I got into it, I found that this whole idea of what we now refer to as empathy and I remember thinking, look, if it works this well for people in crisis, I mean, why can't you apply this in everyday life? Why can't you apply it in business? And that's what I started doing. And one thing led to another. And I involved that stuff in hostage negotiation. Then I involved business negotiation in hostage negotiation. And then I turned it around and came out the other end and started doing business negotiation.
It's amazing. And you wrote in the book, or you gave examples about how the process, the FBI negotiation process, actually changed as a result of emotion and empathy, that it was completely different.
Yeah, and it was really the biggest changes in our kidnapping negotiations, which is bargaining. I mean, it was just bargaining. And we, like most people, bargained really hard without using a lot of emotional intelligence. So I started using emotional intelligence, empathy, if you will. I mean, that's an overused and misunderstood phrase by and large. I'm almost even concerned about using it at all because most people don't agree on what it means. But I put that active use of emotional intelligence into our bargaining, and it made a huge difference. It really changed everything.
Yeah, I mean, you can tell when you read the book. It's do you think that people, it's more about you understanding them than it is getting your way?
And well, that's it exactly. And see, there's an oversimplification there that could be misunderstood. And most people equate understanding to agreement. Or most people agreement that the other side is right or that the other side is even fair or accurate. And understanding the other side's position doesn't include any of those things, which is a really hard part for some people to do because they say, well, I can understand them unless they're wrong. What if they're wrong? I can't understand that. Well, you know, that's not the way the game is played. Understanding doesn't require your approval.
That's a really good point because you can still – I'll use the word – empathize with a situation. And this actually leads me into something that was in the chapter on Be a Mirror. And it kind of discusses these steps on how to confront and get your way without confrontation.
Right.
So maybe you can share those steps. You know which steps I'm talking about. I'm sure.
Yeah, and also this word confrontation, most people are concerned about. I mean, one definition of confrontation is a focused comparison. So if you can shift the whole idea of confrontation so it's not confrontational, or find different ways to feedback what people are saying to you, either word for word or, you know, what are the implications of in-depth of what they're saying. And one of those on Be a Mirror. You know, the hostage negotiator's mirror is not mirroring the other side's body language, a tone of voice, or emotional state. It's just repeating the last three words of what they just said. And that's actually really powerful. People feel a connection. I mean, it makes a connection in their head, and they go on. They say more. They blurt stuff out.
Right, they share more.
It's ridiculous how well it works.
Right, and the more they share, the more information that gives you to understand their situation and probably what they really want. Because, you know, with a lot of the examples that you gave in the book, it's hard to tell what does this kidnapper really want. Like there was one example in the book where the kidnappers just wanted money to party, right? So it wasn't even this big amount. You were actually able to negotiate down, and it was like their idea almost, to a point so that they could have their weekend party money.
Yeah, I mean, it's a crazy thing that I found out working all over the world on kidnappings, a commonality of human beings. And pretty much criminals, if they're criminals, no matter where they are, like everybody else, they want to relax and have a good time on Saturday night. And we knew that the kidnappers in Haiti want to go out and party on Saturday night. So we probably, if we were patient and used patience for us instead of against us, we'd settle on Friday or Saturday morning. And it happened pretty much every time.
Wow. So I want to read the four simple steps because I know these work and I want listeners to hear these steps and maybe you can even explain them a little bit more. So it's the first one is use the late night FM DJ voice. The second is start with I'm sorry. The third is mirror, which you mentioned. The fourth is silence, at least 4 seconds, to let the mirror work its magic on your counterpart. And then there is a fifth step, which is repeat. So you might have to do this again.
Right.
This is a really interesting process. How did you have this in your mind, or did you just naturally do this and it worked?
Well, nobody naturally does anything. All right. Daniel Coyle wrote a great book called The Talent Code, which makes the argument that there's everything is learned. It's just that some people start putting in the 10,000 hours before others do, and they think, oh, poof, you know, there's child prodigy, when in fact, the child got interested in the piano at 2 and was interested for years and nobody knew it. So everything is learned. So I didn't do anything naturally. You know, I got the late night FM DJ voice sort of by accident when I first volunteered on the crisis hotline. And that first call that I took, I think out of fear, maybe, you know, I lapsed into the late night FM DJ.
Very right?
Yeah, and afterwards, you know, the people that were supervising me, coaching me, is like, wow, you, that voice was great. That was really great.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking like, let me think of what I did. But then the second component that you're talking about, that, which is a radically misunderstood notion, I'm sorry. And, you know, it's what women are criticized for doing today in business, saying I'm sorry too much. Well, there's nothing wrong with the words per se. It's a context. And I'm sorry is a great warning device. It's better as a warning device or an apology in advance, which is a warning. Like, I'm sorry you're not going to like this, instead of me telling something that you didn't like to you and then saying I'm sorry. You know, you would have appreciated the heads up that it's coming. And so when it comes out of context like that, it's an attention getter. I need help from somebody at the DMV. You know how helpful they tend to be.
Yeah.
Because they get hammered all day long.
Right.
Or like anybody else in customer service who gets hammered all day long. I'm not picking on them as being bad people. They get hammered all the time.
No, it's just a tough role.
Right. So before I walk in, and when I walk up, I'm going to say, I'm sorry, to get their attention. And their thought is, wow, what's this guy sorry for? And you immediately have their attention when you say it like that. It's a pattern interrupt. It's provocative in a great way. Provokes attention without the other person feeling attacked. So that was the second part. You know, how do I provoke your attention? If I use I'm sorry out of context, because it gets your attention. Then the third part, the mirror. Now that I've said I'm sorry, and you're really wondering what kind of attack is coming, you know, that mirror, the repetition of the last three words, or the gist, but word for word, no more than 1 to 3 words, very, very short. Since your guard is down, now you're not attacked. What I've done is I've kind of hit your thought pattern, and you're going to elaborate, you're going to expand. It's better than asking you to repeat yourself, because you're going to change the words. That's the cool thing about a mirror. If I say to you, what did you mean by that? There's a really good chance you're going to repeat to me exactly the same words you just used.
Right.
And if I say, what did you mean by that? I didn't understand those words. You know, they weren't good enough for me. I'm sorry. I don't understand. So I need to get you to change without you feeling attacked. Because if I say, look, those words are inadequate, or, you know, you might get defensive over the choice of words. And this gets you out of your choice of words in an instant. Without you feeling attacked. And then you elaborate, and either I get clarity out of it, or you give me more information, or you help me understand, or if necessary, if I'm still unclear, wash, rinse, repeat. Do it again.
Exactly. Now, you also in the book talk about the summarizing and the difference when you are able to kind of summarize and somebody says, there's a difference when they say, you're right, and that's right.
That's so huge. And we're so seduced by you're right. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of those things, it's this crazy phrase, depending upon which side of it you're on, it's two different worlds. Like when you're summarizing your perspective and you say you're, and the person you're talking to says you're right, you feel so good.
Yep.
But the flip side of it is when someone just won't let up on you and you can't get them to shut up, you can get them to shut up instantaneously by looking at them and saying, you're right. And they shut right up. You know, and everybody I know does this to shut people up. And simultaneously, without knowing it's being done to shut them up, they're delighted when somebody says you're right to them. I mean, it's the craziest thing. It's like two different languages. So to get out of that, you know, your original question was a summary thing and what's the difference. Now, instead of summarizing my perspective, I need to summarize your perspective. You know, how do you feel about this? How do you see this? This is a Stephen Covey advice. Seek first to understand, then be understood. Except we got to show that we understand. We can't understand. We got to understanding is not enough. You got to show you understand. Take the next step. And when I've completely summarized your perspective in a way that you're satisfied with, then instead of saying you're right, you say that's right.
That's right.
And that's when we followed Covey's advice. And Covey, the second half of that, to be understood. Now you can make your point once the other side feels heard.
So as soon as you get the that's right, then you know you can make your point.
Yeah, you know you can make your point. And in many cases, the deal's going to make itself. Whatever you're trying to accomplish, whatever the negotiation, the most dangerous negotiation is the one you don't know you're in. We negotiate every day,
right.
five to six times a day. People think that it's only a negotiation when money's involved. Money's a commodity involved occasionally in negotiation. The commodity that's always involved is time. Would you go do this? Will you go here with me? Would you sign these documents? Would you execute this plan? Would you pick up the groceries? You know, these are all negotiations, the commitments of our time. And we're in them every day. And when we're seeking collaboration, negotiations about seeking collaboration, the first thing we want from the other side is to be heard. And if we can be heard, in many cases, we'll then be completely amenable to what they want, because all we wanted was to be heard. You can make so many agreements just by hearing the other side out. It's ridiculous.
Exactly. Chris, how important is it to understand your own negotiating style versus your counterpart's negotiating style?
Yeah, it comes up most at impasse. And it's, you know, the crazy thing, it's why the golden rule is flawed. You know, the golden rule is treat others the way you want to be treated. Well, if I want to be treated with direct and honest answers, I mean, that's blunt force trauma. So I'm gonna ask questions, I'm gonna want answers, because that's the way I want to be treated. I mean, that's very off-putting. If the other person isn't exactly like you, and your style is going to cause a mismatch and problems at impasse when you can't figure it out, when you can't get along. You know, a classic one is how people react to silence. Like, some people want silence so they can think.
Mm-hmm.
But other people who are very relationship oriented, which is about a third of the planet, when they're furious, they give people the silent treatment. So to them, it's an indicator of anger. So now imagine the misinterpretation of a moment of silence between one person that sees it as a signal of fury and the other person just being grateful to think for a few moments.
Yeah, that's a great point. That would be confusing.
And it is. And it is. And that's why some understanding of your type is helpful, because the other person's not you. The other person, the chances are that two-thirds of the time, the other person's going to be a completely different style from you. Two-thirds of the time. So if you treat them the way you want to be treated, you're wrong two-thirds of the time.
How hard is it to can you figure out quickly what their style is so that you can adjust your own? Do you think that people have a tough time with this, or this is something, you know, you get better at, it takes practice?
Yeah, you know, any of these things you get better at with practice, with all of them. you get better at with practice. It, you know, they're all versions of emotional intelligence. And the cool thing about emotional intelligence is it's kind of unlimited. All you got to do is try. And it comes to you versus our IQ. Like, you know, you can send your kid to chess camp, math camp, whatever kind of camp you want to try to raise their intellectual capacity. Their IQ is only going to go but so high. You can practice that Rubik's Cube and you're not going to increase your IQ. But if you practice truly understanding other people and reading them in the moment and then feeding back to them what you read for confirmation, because that's really important to feed back what you read is, you'd be surprised at how good you can get at it. And then it's not so much that you need to adjust your style. You just need to let go of the assumption that your style is right and that the other person can be adapted to.
Yeah, I mean, everything you're saying just makes so much sense and also tells me you have to be so present, so in tune with the moment and what's being shared to take it all in and to capture it and to be flexible and adjust.
So yeah, being present is a huge thing. And again, it's just practice.
Practice. Chris, I'm going to ask you just to hold your thoughts for a moment. We're going to take a super quick break, give some love to our sponsor, Pure Performance Communications. And when we get back, we're going to pick up on our discussion about you and more about your work.
Creating brand loyalty requires a unique blend of strategic communications and innovative technology. Yesterday's techniques won't work. Today, you have an opportunity to expand your communications approach with fresh, creative, and effective ways to power up your brand voice through new channels and to interact with more value and meaning. Pure Performance Communications will work with you to move audiences from awareness to action and impact. You'll foster greater engagement and forge stronger relationships along the way. Let us help you uncover what's holding you back and help you to carve out a marketing PR roadmap to success. Visit us at pureperformancecom.com. That's pureperformancecom with two M's.com. Now back to Women Worldwide with Deirdre Breckenridge.
I'm Deirdre Breckenridge. Welcome back to the show. Chris Voss, author, speaker, and CEO of the Black Swan Group, and I were just chatting about his book, which is really awesome. It's Never Split the Difference, Negotiating as If Your Life Depended on It. And Chris was sharing some techniques, and we're just talking about being present. So, Chris, I want to pivot a little bit so listeners can get to know you more. So you're an author, speaker, and you own your own consulting firm. And I'm sure people know a lot about you from your work and what they've read in your book. And maybe you could share something that people don't know about you that you'd like them to know.
Well, you know, I'm a regular guy. I'm a small town Midwestern guy, small town guy from small town Iowa, Mount Pleasant, Iowa. And that culture is just a basic pitch in, figure it out, roll up your sleeves, blue collar culture. That's where it come from.
I love it. And when you were growing up in, you know, your small town, did you ever think that you were going to be a hostage negotiator? Is that something that you were like, oh, I want to join the FBI?
That never occurred to me. It never did.
What did you want to be?
Well, you know, I wanted, when I was about 16, I decided I wanted to go into law enforcement. But I just envisioned myself with the police department. And I don't mean to say just as to denigrate that in any way, shape, or form. But my vision for myself was to be a police officer in a city and just to do that, have a lot of fun, do a lot of good.
That's great. And it's funny, you didn't want to be an officer in your hometown, but you wanted to go to the big city or city near you?
Yeah, I just decided I was attracted to the city environment. You know, I was at the time the closest of the three choices, Kansas City, St. Louis, and Chicago. I opted for Kansas City, loved my time there, wonderfully charming town. was always sort of intrigued by New York, never expected to end up there, and ended up on my journey with the FBI. I was in New York City for 14 years.
Well, I have heard that law enforcement in New York, New York City, can be stressful. I can imagine the amount of stress. So maybe you can describe or share something stressful, and how do you actually manage stress?
Yeah, you know, it's attitude. I mean, it's a cliche. I came across a bumper sticker a few years ago that said the difference between ordeal and adventure is mindset. So, you know, for me, it was an adventure. And that a lot has to do with, you know, what do you see coming out of this? Two people can go through exactly the same experience, and one can be tormented by it, and the other could think it's great. I mean, one of the funniest examples of that I ever heard of, in the late 90s, there was a standoff in Montana between the FBI and a bunch of criminals who called themselves the Freemen. And it was an 88-day standoff where they finally came out.
Wow.
And it was in the middle of nowhere. And because it was in the middle of nowhere, the FBI agents that were there couldn't stay in hotels. I mean, they put our guys up in cots and barns in the dead of winter with no heat. Now, all the city guys, and the vast majority of the agents that were there was like, this is awful. This stinks. I should be in a hotel. And complaining about it. But there was one city guy from New York that his whole life wanted to camp out. And he had the best time. He said, this is great. We're out here in the middle of nowhere. We're sleeping on cots and barns. And I love this.
Right. It's just perspective. It's mindset.
Yeah. And everybody was looking at him like he was taking some sort of drugs and he should pass a drug test. But he was just having the best time.
That's pretty funny. Chris, I was going to ask you in the first segment, but I didn't get a chance to. Maybe, if you don't mind, could you just share one of your hostage standoffs that you've negotiated? Maybe just a situation that stands out in your mind and share why?
Well, I mean, the one that springs to mind quickest was, and it's in the book, we had some fugitives trapped in an apartment in Harlem on a 27th floor of a high rise. And we took the circus there, so to speak. We took the FBI SWAT team. We took the investigators, you know, the entire entourage, the 800-pound gorilla. By the time we got to the 27th floor of this building in Harlem, and Harlem was a much more dangerous place than it is in these days, we figured they were gone. There's no way they didn't hear the circus coming to town, right?
Right.
So, and we had snipers on tops of the buildings around just to watch the windows. And so by the time we got up there, I mean, we spoke, it was one-way dialogue, no response on the inside, and every hostage negotiator at some point in time is going to talk to an empty building or an empty house or an empty apartment. So I figured this was just our time. And I had a couple new guys with me and I figured, all right, you got to practice one-way dialogue. And we talked for 6 hours with no response to what I was thoroughly convinced was a vacant apartment. And 6 hours in, one of the snipers saw movement on the curtains, and everybody was like, we're shocked. And what we kept saying to him, I mean, what do you say one-way dialogue? We said, you know, we know you're scared. We know you don't want to come out. We know you don't want to go to jail. And we're not going away. We use a late-night FM DJ voice. We put ourselves in their place. You know, if I'm trapped in an apartment, no matter how bad I am, I'm going to be scared. I'm going to feel alone. I'm going to feel I don't want to go to jail. And I know, I knew instinctively then, I know scientifically now the same thing. Calling out negative emotions diffuses them. It doesn't reinforce them. So let me call out, not deny, but just observe the elephant in the room. You don't get rid of the elephant in the room by denying it. You get rid of the elephant by recognizing its existence. And after we saw the curtain move about 20 minutes later, they came out one at a time and they never, ever said a word until after they came out.
That's an unbelievable story.
It was cool.
Yeah, 6 hours of thinking that it was that no one was there.
Yeah, I figured it was good practice. I mean, I was in charge of the negotiation team at the time. I had already spoken, I'd already had my turn speaking to an empty house probably about a year earlier. Every negotiator I knew had it on their resume. So, you know, it's another thing you got to do. And I had two newer people with me, and I, you know, I would take my turn for 20 minutes at a time demonstrating how to do it. And then I'd say, all right, now you're up. Do the same thing I did. Talk for 20 minutes.
Wow.
Now go. And we talked them up.
How do the new people do?
You know, new people after good training tend to do really well. It's when, you know, they let their training diminish. It's a great communication is a perishable skill. Emotional intelligence is a perishable skill. It's like any other performance endeavor that we as human beings engage in. And without practice, we lose it. And usually right after training, we're really sharp. And we're so sharp, we forget to practice. So if you don't practice, you lose it. And they did well. They followed the lead well. They were willing. They were open to being coached. And I coached them, and they nailed it. They did a great job.
That's fantastic. So your career is different now. I mean, you just shared about hostage or kidnappers or people who are criminals who are holed up. And now, you know, author, speaker, business owner. So what have you learned about yourself?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I like this stuff. I mean, applying it is satisfying. We, you know, we dig helping people. We help people make great deals, and we're into it, and we breathe it, and we hear about talk about it all the time. I mean, the significant others in our lives are sick of hearing about this stuff because it's all we want to talk about.
Right.
But, you know, we're having an impact, and that's ongoing. I mean, I when I was with the FBI, I wanted to have an impact, and we're helping people in the business community make deals. We're on a phone last night with one of our clients, and we have this strategy, which is very counterintuitive, and it's very proactive, of calling out all the negatives the other side could be feeling. Again, not denying them. Just calling them out. We call this thing the accusations audit, make a list of all the things the other side could call you, all the names they could call you, and beat them to the punch. Say, you know, you probably think I'm a jerk, whatever it may be, like I'm a bully, we're not listening, we're self-centered, we're pushing you around, we're unappreciative, ungrateful. And our client got on the phone last night to recap the negotiation that they just came into, and they said, hey, you know, we start out with the accusations audit, and the other side, the deal made itself. We just laid out all the things, the names they could call us, and they turn around and they made the deal. And like nearly instantly, it happens all the time. And it's so cool.
That is really cool. You know, I remember reading in the book, you shared how, I don't know if it was a student or a colleague actually turned the tables on you.
No, nobody ever turned. Come on. What do you got to bring that up for? What are you trying to do here? Are you sure it was my book that you were reading?
Yeah, it was. It was. Yeah. Was it a student who did that? Share with the audience.
Well, students have got me a few times, but this happened to be one of the guys that was working with us, for us. And, you know, real quiet dude. His name is Keenan. And Keenan, we were grateful for the time that he spent with us. And we're still good friends with him and still in touch with him. And Keenan and my son, Brandon, is my director of operations and really the uncredited co-author of the book. You know, they were on their way over to meet with me. And Keenan says to my son, Brandon, he says, you know what? I'm going to watch. When we start talking, I'm going to mirror Chris the entire time. And so we sat down and we're good solid 45 minutes into a conversation that I think is going great. I mean, I am talking and they are listening and I'm talking some more. And finally, about 45 minutes in, my son Brandon goes, I can't take it anymore. He's been marrying you the whole time. Stop it. It's driving me crazy. And I was like, what are you talking about?
It's hysterical.
Yeah, so yeah, be going.
You felt good. You felt really good about that conversation.
I thought it was going great. I was having the best time.
Of course. That's funny. Chris, who has influenced you the most in your life and your career?
My father. My father, and then my mom. My dad was a hardworking, straight ahead, honest man. And, you know, I learned hard work and integrity from my dad. He was blunt as heck, too. So, you know, I constantly worked at not being so blunt. And my mom is less blunt and probably tougher than my father was. And my mother is still around. And, you know, the joke that I like, that, you know, my mom is a tough Midwestern gal. And my favorite joke is, what's the difference between a Midwestern mom and a terrorist? You can negotiate with a terrorist.
Has she ever heard you tell that joke?
She has. The first time she heard it, she laughed. Whenever she hears it now, she goes, I don't think that's funny anymore. And I posted it on Facebook one time, and everybody knew that knows my mom said, yeah, especially your mom.
That's funny. So, Chris, with you creating your own business, right? So moving from FBI to business owner, was there anybody in your life who was an entrepreneur, or you know, either of your parents? Where does that come from?
Both my parents were. My dad had his own small business, ran his own operation. You know, I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I always knew I wanted to have my own business. I was going to let my law enforcement career run its course. 3 years with the police department and 24 with the FBI. So, you know, I put in 24 years.
No, that's a long stretch.
27 years in public service. But I always wanted to have my own business. And I thought I would took an entrepreneurial approach to everything that I did within the government. And then when I got out, I wanted to start my own business. And I did. And my son's involved. And
great.
And now my daughter-in-law is involved, and we've got a very close colleague, and, you know, it's a cool thing. I mean, we're helping people make their lives better, and I'm also helping the people that work for me, you know, make their lives better.
What do you think, besides being a good negotiator, makes a great entrepreneur?
Well, that's a hard thing, because if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go as a team. Mm-hmm. A lot of entrepreneurs are solo players. And they've achieved a tremendous amount of success under their own skills. But it's, you know, you need a team. And you need to be not just a quarterback, but sometimes you need to be second fiddle. Sometimes you need to be the wingman. So, you know, really functioning as a cog in a team and then leading a team, in my estimation, if you've succeeded as an individual, that's a tough transition. And I'm still working on that.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's true, because a lot of what you do and where you can go is based on your own skills and strengths. But, you know, having a strong team and knowing when to take a backseat, sometimes that's so hard as an entrepreneur. You know, even to the point of delegating something and not saying, oh, I could just get this done myself, when it's so much better in somebody else's hands, right?
Yeah. Or developing people and walking a fine line between taking care of your team and taking care of the people you serve. So, and boy, ego will get in your way. I mean, there was a movie a long time ago, Lawrence of Arabia, and one of the Arab leaders, after a great victory, he was walking around the leader, I think played by Anthony Quinn, is walking around at all the other chieftains' campfires and paying homage to them. When he led everybody into battle, he was the leader. And he ran around and paid homage to everybody else. And Lawrence, I think, finally says to him, what are you doing? I mean, you're the leader. He said, yeah, but I got to take care of these guys. I got to make them feel happy that they contributed to my success. And I do it by showing them respect.
Right. Yeah, no ego. And something tells me in negotiation, you better check your ego at the door.
Yeah, well, you're going to be wrong if you don't. You're going to miss the mark if you don't. Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely gets in the way. Chris, maybe you can just share some advice, parting advice for listeners about making better negotiations and never splitting the difference.
Yeah, well, let the other side go first. I mean, never split the difference. There are two aspects to that, you know, and the flip side of it is that the other side might be right. So if you hear them out first, if they have a better idea than you do, you know, we tell people never be so sure of what you want that you wouldn't take something better. you know, never split the difference. Maybe take their idea, be open to their idea or open to them making your idea better.
Yeah, it's so true. And don't jump in first just to hear yourself and to kind of give where you stand, but wait and hear what the other side has to say.
Because it's not possible for you to be completely right.
Right.
You know, and I can explain that to people intellectually, and people understand it intellectually, because they say, all right, so it's, I can lay it out and I can prove to you that you can't have all the information. And it's called, you know, some people, academics call it perfect information. Military people call it asymmetric information, you know, a dynamic environment where you don't know everything. So if you don't know everything, you can't possibly be right, because there's stuff you don't know. You got to find out from the other side.
Exactly. Let the other side go first. That's great advice. Chris, last question. Super easy. Where can people find out more about you, your work, and your book?
All right. So the best thing to do is to subscribe to our newsletter. We put out a once a month negotiation newsletter, or once a week, called The Edge, and it's short and sweet. And it's also the gateway to everything we do. It's a gateway to our website, which is blackswanltd.com. You can also find out how to buy our book, Never Split the Difference. It will connect you straight through to Amazon, the quickest way onto Amazon to buy it. Amazon has the best price. But to subscribe to the newsletter, the short, simple way to do it is send a text message. The message is FBI empathy, all one word. Don't let your spell check make a mistake and put a space between there. And then you got to send it. You got to make sure you get the number right. It's 22828, and it's 22828. And you'll get a text message back to sign up for the newsletter. It's concise. There aren't 50 options, so you get tired just trying to decide what to read. And it really gets people going. It's a great supplement to the book. Almost everybody that's read the book is also subscribing to the newsletter because they like how it keeps them sharp.
I have to subscribe because I love the book and I want to stay sharp.
It's a great supplement and it's free. You know, it's a good price.
That's wonderful. Well, I hope everybody subscribes. Chris, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I would recommend your book to everyone. It is a must read. Women Worldwide listeners, this is a must read for 2019. Chris, we appreciate your time, your insights, your stories, everything that you've shared about how to be a better negotiator. Thank you. We've learned so much from you.
Deidre, my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, such a pleasure. And I want to thank all of you for tuning in to Women Worldwide. Thank you again for spreading the word about our show. We're receiving a lot of positive feedback, so keep it coming. Please rate us on iTunes. Give us a shout out on Twitter or Facebook. We always love hearing from you. Okay, friends, until our next episode, stay focused, energized, and feeling empowered. Thank you.